From WKAR Studios at Michigan State University, welcome back to the second half hour of Current State. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick, catching you up on what's happening around the Capital Region and the Great Lakes. A new ordinance to regulate marijuana business in Lansing was all set when a petition stopped it from happening. A group submitted enough signatures to the city clerk's office to suspend the ordinance. WKAR's Katie Cook has more on what this means.
When Let Lansing Vote turned in about 6,400 signatures to repeal the marijuana ordinance last Friday, it stopped the new ordinance from going into effect. Now the city has to review and verify the signatures and either repeal the ordinance or place it before the voters. And council would have to call a special election for that in May of 2018 at the earliest. So what happens in the meantime? City Clerk Chris Swope explains.
Once this referendum was submitted, we revert back to before the ordinance was adopted, which means that the 2011 ordinance is now actually in place.
But the 2011 ordinance has some outdated language.
It doesn't actually address most of the changes in state law. So council is working to make some amendments to the 2011 ordinance just to make it workable so that we would be able to issue licenses, because that's the only thing that could be done between now and May.
At Monday night's council meeting, council members proposed amendments to bring the 2011 ordinance up to date. Is there much difference between this amended 2011 ordinance and the 2017 ordinance?
The 2011 ordinance has a requirement that the establishments be 1,000 feet from one another, whereas in the 2017 ordinance, the distance limitation was just on provisioning centers and it was 500 feet. So yes, the 2011 ordinance is more restrictive.
He also explained another difference. The 2017 ordinance caps the number of dispensaries or provisioning centers at 25. There are no caps on other types of facilities. Remember, besides dispensaries, there are also grow operations, processing facilities, secure transporters, and safety compliance centers, which are labs. But the 2011 ordinance that we're dealing with now has a cap of 48, and that applies to all types of marijuana facilities. How many dispensaries it allows is undefined, and Chris Swope says council is working to clarify that.
It's my understanding that the intention is to stay as close to possible as the 2011 ordinance, because it's not really the intent to try and circumvent the right of the people to do this referendum. So my understanding is the 48 cap on all types will remain.
The timeline from here looks like this. City Council will hold a public hearing on this revised version of the 2011 ordinance on October 30th. They will consider it for final passage on November 13th. A month before the state of Michigan starts issuing their licenses on December 15th. And if you're wondering, like I was, could that one also be petitioned in the same way?
Yes. Yeah.
So this could go on forever.
Potentially. It could.
For WKAR News, I'm Katie Cook.
We know there's a lot to digest on this issue, so log on to WKAR.org. Click on the Marijuana in Michigan section on the right-hand side of the page. You can read up on the latest new local and state medical marijuana rules and the push to legalize recreational use, again at WKAR.org.
Like a good neighbor.
The commercial messages that have stuck with generations and perhaps even persuaded you to buy food or insurance or other products started with the man you're about to hear from. Keith Reinhardt is a legend in the advertising industry. He is also chairman emeritus of DDB. He is on the Michigan State University campus this week, and he was generous enough to spend some time with us.
Thank you, Reginald. It's nice to be here.
When people think of big advertising, they may think of New York City, but your roots are right here in the Midwest.
Well, I grew up in a small farming community in northeastern Indiana. My mother was widowed at a very young age, and she worked in a very tiny grocery store. Companies like Kraft Foods and Campbell Soup and Mars Candies and General Mills, Betty Crocker, sent in promotional materials, but the store was too small to display those materials. And so I would take them home and study them and say, wow, you know, somebody writes those lines, so much milk in a Milky Way, you can almost hear it moo, you know, who writes that stuff? And the logos and the pictures. And Betty Crocker was my first pinup girl. So I had a fascination at an early age. It was a strict Mennonite community, so we weren't allowed to watch television, even though television was just barely on the scene. But my grandfather allowed me to listen to radio, and so I'm a big fan of radio. But the jingles captured my attention. Have you tried Wheaties? They're whole wheat with all of the bran and best breakfast food in the land. So I got fascinated by the thought of advertising. I didn't know anything about it, but somebody out there was doing those things, and that appealed to me.
You know, one of the campaigns that you're so closely associated with is the You Deserve a Break Today slogan.
Well, we won the McDonald's national account in 1970. We really studied the ideas that Ray Kroc, the founder, had. And he once said in his high-pitched voice, Americans can probably make better hamburgers in their backyard, but they can't have the experience, the wonderful experience of taking their family to a place that's clean, where the prices are low, where the kids can get their favorite food, not have to worry about vegetables or table manners. And so we found early on, and we had some very good researchers and planners who led us to this insight, that what we're selling is an experience rather than a burger. In those days, women were still referred to as housewives, and we interviewed a lot of them, and they said they were tired of meal planning. What am I going to fix tonight? You know, another boil in the bag. And then dads that we talked to were saying, we'd like to take the family out to dinner, but it's so costly. And so our original line was not, you deserve a break today. That was sort of something we got into after they rejected our original line. And thank goodness they did. But we went back into the focus groups, and we heard the women use the word break for a while. And so it was just a matter of figuring out how to put that word in a phrase that would be memorable and sound like natural language. You deserve a break today. And the idea that this was an indulgence that they deserved. It wasn't something they should feel guilty about. So it really took off and was quite successful and redefined the eating out category in some ways. You deserve a break today. Originally, it was you deserve a break today, so get up and get away at McDonald's. Then they got a threatening letter from a babysitter who said, I was sitting with a child, taking care of the child, and suddenly I looked up and the child was gone. The child had gone to McDonald's because he heard, so get up and get away to McDonald's. And then the other reason we dropped that part of it was we started going from 60-second commercials to 30, and we needed to shorten it.
How has advertising shifted from those times in the 1970s with the McDonald's ad to now?
Well, there have been a lot of changes. I mean, the internet brought amazing changes and gave us capabilities to do things we never could have imagined. First of all, in the days prior to the internet, when we had an idea, a campaign, we'd say, how do we extend the campaign? And we had three ways to extend the campaign. One was by public relations. Let's do a publicity stunt and have all the media write about Ronald McDonald being at a certain hospital or whatever. We had sales promotion, you know, back to school days and whatever. And we had direct mail. Well, when internet came along, we could do all those things without any problem. I mean, we didn't have to worry about direct mail. We now communicate directly, and pretty soon people could actually buy. They could not only interact with the brand, but they could actually make their purchase online. So we didn't need direct mail. Public relations, we could create events that created a buzz overnight. And with sales promotion, the same thing. So that changed everything. The big change, of course, was we always tried to engage the consumer with stories, with advertising messages, but we engaged their mind, their intellect, and their emotions. With the internet and interactivity, we could not only do that, we could engage them physically. They could respond to us and we could respond to them. And then the good thing, we've always said word of mouth is the best medium of all. Now we have word of web. So when I can get a consumer to respond positively to our message, the great thing is she will share it with all of her friends on social media. So we have not only engaged the consumer, but all of her friends as well. The bad thing is if it's a bad message and she hates it, the same thing is true.
Is there a advertisement or campaign or brand that's doing it pretty well, in your opinion?
The best example of building a brand and brand integrity, in my opinion, is Apple. You know, Steve Jobs said he felt his purpose on the planet was to create devices that would help people improve their lives. And channeling Leonardo da Vinci, I think, he said, simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. And so his devices were going to be not only aesthetically attractive, but easy to use. And the obsession he had with that simplicity and that aesthetic carried over into packaging, into the Apple stores, into every product design, brands, a brand built on a simple idea, and continues the integrity of that brand throughout everything they do.
I've been talking with Keith Reinhardt, Chairman Emeritus of DDB. A few weeks ago, you took part in a Rehabilitating Brand America session. And where does the U.S. as a country reputation stand internationally, and how can it be repaired?
Well, yes, that was an interesting session. The reputation of the United States across 37 countries, according to the Pew Center, has never been worse. And it took a nosedive when we elected the current president. For 8 years prior, perceptions of the United States across those 37 countries had been positive. Then it took a nosedive, and now, since June, it's even gotten worse because of a number of things that have occurred since then. What the good news is, in that same study, people in 37 countries, with some exceptions, have a very favorable impression of Americans, positive view of Americans as people, and also a positive view of many aspects of American culture, our music, our movies. Not all, some of the Muslim majority countries do not share that, but mostly those two positives, I think, give us some hope. What can be done about it? We have to enlist the business community, even to a greater extent than they are already serving as ambassadors of goodwill. Because big multinational U.S. companies have ambassadors everywhere in their companies. And so we have to make sure that they are presenting the good part of who Americans are, what we believe in, the way we value our values, the way we value each other. Interesting, though, you mentioned that event. We also commissioned a company to see whether this negativity toward America is affecting American brands. And given the limitations of time and budget, they were only able to check two brands in one country. But it was very interesting. They checked Nike and Budweiser. And they have an algorithm which is just amazing. It's like a focus group of the world. They are listening in to every social media conversation, every chat room, whatever. And there are no prompts. They just listen. So they had 1,200 conversations in the UK. And Budweiser came out very well because many people had seen the Super Bowl commercial that Budweiser did, where Adolphus Bush was coming as an immigrant to the United States. And the verbatims in this research were quite interesting. Said, I still think Budweiser tastes awful, and I would never drink it, but now I'm going to drink Budweiser because I really like that they're standing up for immigration in the face of the travel bans, which Budweiser said was never their intention. But that was so positive in all of the conversations. When it got to product, it was all negative, but net positive. Nike had the opposite effect. People had seen their video using mostly black athletes talking about equality, and it was a very well-done commercial. But the comments were about corporate hypocrisy. You are running sweatshops in Asia, and now you're talking about equality? I don't think so. And so they had all negatives. But generally speaking, U.S. brands are valued based on what they are doing and what they're saying, not on the fact that they're U.S.-based. There seems to be a detachment from U.S. brands. So what those brands can do is do great things and then identify themselves as American. That will help. Some brands are trying to do the opposite. They're trying to be local. They're trying to, Ford in the UK tries to say we're a UK company, and Coca-Cola in China is a Chinese company. Let's let them do wonderful things and then say, hey, we're American.
What do you see going forward in advertising? I mean, what is there any specific trends or things that you're seeing going forward?
Well, I'm optimistic. For the last half of the 20th century, we had the creative revolution, and we were doing really good storytelling. And then came, at the end of the century, came the digital disruption with all the amazing new tools we had so that we could, you know, theoretically, we could better target our audience and measure the effectiveness of our messages instantaneously in real time. That was bad. I started calling it the digital distraction, and I started quoting Thoreau, who at the end of another century said, I fear men have become tools of their tools, because it was each shiny new device, hey, well, look what we can do now, as opposed to what should we be doing. Now, I think we're starting to see a period where we're over our obsession. We now know that technology can do anything, and that we'll be navigating a tsunami of technological innovation, relentless. So how do we take those things we learned in the creative revolution about storytelling and craft and emotional connection and combine those with the amazing tools we have in the digital disruption and come to a new phase, which I've calling the ultimate revelation, I thought sounded sort of prophetic and a little biblical. And what will be revealed in this new period, and we're already starting to see a little bit of this, is there's still a difference between creating a buzz and creating a brand. There's a difference between a click and a true connection. There's a difference between a one-off stunt and an enduring brand story. There's a difference between big data and a big idea. And we'll need all these data, and we'll need these tools, but we'll now use them in ways that value and exploit those things we learned in the creative revolution. That's why I think we're going to see more storytelling. And now, of course, we have with YouTube and the broadband, and we have long-form stories, so we can really get back into the storytelling business. The threat is short-termness, short-termitis, or whatever you want to call it. The problem that affects a lot of businesses, which is shareholder primacy, and we can't make a commitment to build a brand over time because the CEO and the CMO wants 3 months results. That is a threat. But I'm optimistic that we're in a spot now where we have all these tools. Also, by the way, we're starting to see that total reliance on data can lead you astray. I mean, Hillary found that out in the last election.
I'll wrap up with this. Advertising is about storytelling. What is Keith Reinhardt's story?
Well, we were a few weeks ago, an organization in New York asked some of us to answer three questions with one word per question. And the question was one word about your career. And my word without hesitation was lucky. I just found a way to get into this business, and I just can't think of a more exciting profession where else could you get to work with words, the spoken word, the printed word, the sung word, the moving picture, this digital picture, the arts of media, the ologies, psychology, anthropology, technology, and all the business arts, and all do that with most amazing people, interesting, different, crazy. I can't think of any better place to be. So I just, I got out of that little town in Indiana 30 minutes after I graduated from high school. I love going back there, but the advertising profession has been just great for me. I started as a copywriter. I didn't even have a cubicle. I had a workstation next to the soda and coffee machine, so I couldn't even concentrate. I made change every day for everybody, and I got to know everybody in the agency, so they made me CEO. That's my story.
It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, and we've been talking with Keith Reinhardt, Chairman Emeritus of DDB. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time and spending time with us here at Current State.
Thank you, Reginald. Pleasure.
Since 1999, as many as 100 different school districts, including homeschool groups, have sent teams to compete on WKAR's Quizbusters. But this fall will be the final run of the award-winning series. WKAR Morning Edition host Brooke Allen talked with the host of Quizbusters about how he's come up with the questions throughout the years, and a whole lot more.
Claire Joel.
Cleft?
No, I'm sorry, that's not right. Homer, any ideas? He's the fiddler crab. The fiddler crab. I guess that's he has the big claw to do that, although I doubt he's very good at it. That's the end of the Quick 10. We're here to play Quizbusters.
WKAR presents Quizbusters. Now, here's the host of Quizbusters, Matt Ottinger.
And just like that, these eight players have Quizbusters experience.
And just like that, you are right here in front of me, Matt Ottinger.
Glad to be here, Brooke.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. So let's start at the beginning. You are from Tennessee.
Grew up in Tennessee. Grew up in a suburb of Knoxville on the east side.
And did you always want to host your own TV show?
Oh, golly. My own game show. Yes. Absolutely. Since I was a little kid, I was fascinated by the games, which back then were on in the daytime all day long. So all through the summers and any time I was sick or could pretend to be sick, I would take a day off and I would listen to watch game shows. And I loved them from the beginning. And honestly, from as long as I can remember, I wanted to host one.
So this is pretty much your dream come true.
Absolutely. It has been for 29 years.
So Quizbusters, you write your own questions.
Well, I want to say we, and that's a little strong.
Okay.
What happens is a great majority of what we get from national writing services. There is an insatiable need for this kind of material for quiz bowl games that happen besides our television show all over the country. So there are companies that specialize in this kind of thing. Those companies tend to write really hard questions. So what we do when we get those questions from those companies is the word I like to use is edit. Some people might like to say water down, I'm not sure. But we try to make them a little bit more accessible both to students who maybe don't have as much Quiz Bowl experience and, frankly, to an audience that doesn't want to hear the most esoteric thing about a chemical formula or doesn't want to watch students working on a complicated math question. They want to hear questions that they can answer. So we do a lot of editing of the material to get it to where we like it for a television show.
Okay, so let's talk about the contestants, which are kids.
Right.
29 years, you've seen a lot of kids.
Absolutely. You've got to think, four on a team, 64 teams for most of the run that we've done the show. Some of them come back more than once, of course. So thousands and thousands of students. And they're my favorite part of it because it's fun to watch their minds work. If we've crafted a question just right, there's a process where you figure out the clues in the question and piece them all together to come up with an answer. And when you see that light go off, it's real obvious. And that's one of my favorite parts of the show is when they start out thinking, maybe I'm not going to know this answer. And then they realize by the end of the question, oh, yeah, I can use what I know, even though I haven't heard it worded quite that way before, and come up with the right one.
What's your favorite question?
Well, I'll tell you, the favorite question I have, because I get asked that a lot.
Okay.
But it's not really a Quizbusters question. What I like to answer with that is, what's the last word of the Pledge of Allegiance? Now, let me tell you while you're thinking about that, because I can see your mind working. I can see your lights going
on. I'm panicking.
Off. The beautiful thing about that question is a 60-year-old knows the answer. A first grader knows the answer. It's just a matter of how quickly your brain works and gets to the end.
To catch up.
Right. Maybe you can just say, and justice for all. And all is the right answer.
Right.
But maybe you have to start at the beginning. I pledge allegiance to the flag. Anybody can get there. It's not a hard question, but it's a fun question to see how quickly you can get there. And that's, in a sense, that's what Quizbusters is all about, although I'd never ask that particular question on the show.
Are you going to in this final season?
Well, now it's been spoiled on the radio, so I don't think I can.
You don't think you can. Okay. So Quizbusters airing on Saturday on WKAR-TV at what time?
6 p.m.
All right, sir. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Brooke. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And you can watch Quizbusters on WKAR-TV, Channel 23, Saturdays at 6 p.m. this fall. And Matt will have some more moments with Rook in the coming weeks. That's it for this week's Current State. WKAR station manager is Peter Worf. Our general manager is Susie Elkins. And I'm digital news director Reginald Hardwick. We leave you now with Thelonious Monk, one of the greatest composers of the 20th century, who would have turned 100 years old last week. Enjoy your weekend.